This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup, a wrap-up of the week with background and analysis from the correspondents who cover the news. And now from Washington, here's CBS News national correspondent Dan Revie.
The fragile U.S. economy doesn't need this, a large hurricane swirling up the East Coast. And that's after a rare earthquake in the East. You'll hear how Washington, D.C. was all shaken up. And the federal government tells anyone in Hurricane Irene's path, take it seriously. It's a dangerous storm. In Libya, anti-Qaddafi forces capture the capital, and we'll speak with the U.S. ambassador to Libya, helping to coordinate American support for the rebels.
They have showed us that their ideals and that their vision for a future democratic Libya are very much consistent with ours.
A lot more coming up with Ambassador Gene Kratz. And here in D.C., the new Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial. We'll hear from CBS's Pam Coulter.
The theme of the King Memorial is, out of a mountain of despair, a stone of hope. 88-year-old Dabney Montgomery got a message of strength.
Don't hate, but stand. Don't compromise. That's what he's saying up there.
And we'll talk about Steve Jobs, head of Apple, stepping down. Think about the products he introduced. Maybe you're listening on an iPod or an iPad. But first, Hurricane Irene, the first landfall on the mainland United States by an Atlantic hurricane in 3 years. And Irene is wide, powerful, and expected to whip Americans with wind and rain all the way up the East Coast. It's fairly common for North Carolina to get hit first. CBS News correspondent Mark Strassman reported on preparations there.
With a new generator and groceries, Patricia Cardwell's afraid Irene could be North Carolina's Katrina.
I'm here by myself, and it's just scary.
But Cardwell's more scared no hotel would take her dog, Zach.
Where's your toys?
So she's staying put at her home in Wilmington.
I won't go. That's my dog. He's the only thing I got here.
Mandatory evacuations for 3,000 tourists started on Ocracoke Island, off North Carolina's Outer Banks, accessible only by boat. Melanie Gordon and Patrice Parks put up no fight.
Mandatory. We didn't have a choice. We had to go.
No charge for the ferry, though, back.
That was cool.
Edna McKelvey headed in the opposite direction, back to Ocracoke to pick up her mother.
It's mandatory for the residents. And she's elderly and she has heart problems and pacemaker.
I'm Jim Crisula on the North Carolina coast. Hurricane Irene couldn't come at a worse time for coastal businesses that have already seen fewer tourist dollars because of the economy.
And thank goodness, in a way, it's not happening this Labor Day weekend. It's happening before the Labor Day this weekend. So we don't need to lose more business than we lost already with a bad economy.
Surf shop owner Rico Belloy. Jim Crisula, CBS News, Atlantic Beach, North Carolina.
And more reports we had on the radio on Friday.
I'm Peter Mayer on Martha's Vineyard. President Obama is cutting his visit here short to oversee
our ongoing federal preparations for what's likely to be an extremely dangerous and costly storm.
Officials had insisted the president could handle storm contingencies from his vacation home, but he concluded it would be prudent to be at the White House when the hurricane makes landfall in the Carolinas.
Also on Friday, we heard from WCBS Radio's Sean Adams on the Jersey Shore in one of the beach communities usually so pleasant this time of year.
While some folks eked out one last bit of beach fun under a glorious sun, others packed up, boarded up, and left this thin sliver of land, sandwiched between the Atlantic Ocean and a bay. Seaside Park lifeguard Captain Joe Gomulka says, be afraid, he witnessed Hurricane Bell's surge in 76.
It's funny how quickly the water comes up. The water sweeps along the beach, so if you're anywhere near that water, you know, you're definitely not making it back. It's taking you with you.
He says, don't tempt Irene, the beast. Sean Adams, CBS News, Seaside Park, New Jersey.
The hurricane comes just days after an earthquake here on the East Coast. Epicenter near Richmond, Virginia, felt very distinctly 90 miles away here in Washington, D.C. Some minor damage to the National Cathedral, a few other buildings, and the tall, thin Washington Monument closed to visitors due to cracks that need to be repaired.
I look around. I thought under my car is something moving my car. I was nervous.
That driver thought his car had been struck from behind.
I was parking at the Four Seasons Hotel Georgetown. Then first is I thought somebody's hit me in the back. My car is going shaking like this. When I look, it's No car behind me.
These women were in Washington, D.C. offices.
It was just everything shaking. So at first it kind of felt like somebody was moving furniture or something upstairs. And then your monitor started shaking. So we just all got in the doorways.
Oh, it was terrifying. We thought it was a big truck outside, you know, when it rumbles the building. And then it just kept going. And then we looked outside and ran.
And many people admitted they feared it was some terrorist explosion. This was a magnitude 5.8 earthquake. Many people on the West Coast laughed at us for getting all nervous about it. But here in D.C. and up the coast in New York City, even up to Massachusetts and as far west as Chicago, it was felt, and it was an unsettling surprise. Now to the very big foreign story of the week. In Libya, the rebels entered the capital, Tripoli. But Colonel Muammar Gaddafi vanished, shades of Saddam Hussein in Iraq 8 years ago. CBS News correspondent Barry Peterson reported from Tripoli on Monday.
You could sum up the mood in rebel-held areas in one word, joyful. Families brought their small children to be a part of it, and destroyed tanks were photo ops of change.
It's a new day. It's a, really, it's a feeling of a new day.
And it's unbelievable. It's so happy. I cannot explain this to you in words.
There's many snipers from Gaddafi military.
Even the rebels were surprised at how little resistance they faced in their initial advance. The spoils of war for the rebels included anti-tank weapons, Gaddafi's ammo to be used against him.
Then the next day, Tuesday, Barry Peterson in helmet and bulletproof vest advanced with the anti-Gaddafi men into the dictator's large complex of buildings, the Bab al-Azizia.
This is the moment the rebels have been waiting for. They've breached the walls. There's heavy fighting back there. They're now in Gaddafi's compound. Resistance was slim and the rebels' firepower overwhelming.
You found the people is die. After that, we found many guns.
Dead people and many guns.
Yeah.
A prize that came with prizes of its own. Anything that could be carried. Hundreds of weapons. A baby carriage for twins. And this lucky man found a signature hat that the world has often seen on the dictator's head.
I mean, Gaddafi's rule. Oh, my God. I was like, oh, my goodness.
But the big prize eluded them. The tyrant himself, nowhere to be found.
What about Gaddafi?
We don't found them there. Maybe he's still underground. Yeah.
From now on, we will have a new Libya. We will have a new Libya.
That from CBS's Barry Peterson in Tripoli. Please stay tuned. We'll speak with the U.S. ambassador to Libya on why America supports these rebels.
Stay with us on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Once again, here's correspondent Dan Rabee.
In a moment, our interview with the U.S. ambassador to Libya. But first, let's talk about Steve Jobs, who revolutionized home computing and brought us the iPod, the iPhone, the iPad, and other products from Apple. He's announced he's stepping down as chief executive of that company. It's assumed because of his health. Jobs has battled pancreatic cancer. He had a liver transplant. CBS News and CNET tech analyst Larry Magid, are you worried about Apple's ability now to innovate and create new products?
I don't think it has a huge impact short term for a number of reasons. Number one, there are still products in the pipeline. So for the next couple of years, we'll probably still be seeing products that Steve Jobs conceptualized or had a role in as CEO. Number two, he's being succeeded by Tim Cook, who is already the acting CEO since Jobs went on medical leave in January, and also he served as acting CEO when Jobs was out for his liver transplant. And finally, Jobs is going to remain as chairman of Apple. We don't know for how long, but we do know he's going to be playing an active role in the company, not as active as he has as CEO. But you better believe that Tim Cook and other executives will be coming to his house, showing him products, and making sure he weighs in for as long as he can do that.
However, Larry, a lot of the news coverage sounded almost like an obituary. Steve Jobs has not passed away. I guess what we're doing is paying tribute to the fact that this man in his mid-50s has had a big impact on the products we buy, how we inform and entertain ourselves.
That's right, and I'm glad you mentioned that, because it's more than just technology products. First of all, he helped create the personal computer industry. He co-founded Apple with Steve Wozniak and helped develop the first popular personal computer. He brought us the Macintosh graphical user interface. He brought us the iPod, the iPhone, the iPad. But he also started Pixar, which had a big impact on the making of animated movies. And he's now on the board of Disney. And he totally disrupted the music industry with iTunes and the iPod. I don't know where it ends. He's had a big impact on a lot of things.
So let's call it a tribute and wish him well when it comes to his health.
I do wish him well. And, you know, we're not exactly neighbors, but I live in the same community as he, and I've known him for a while. As far as I'm concerned, he's a national treasure.
Well, that's our man in Northern California, usually, CNET and CBS News tech analyst Larry Maggott. Thank you, Larry.
Thanks, Dan.
Now the United States ambassador to Libya, longtime diplomat Gene Kratz. He has not been in Tripoli all this year, first because Colonel Gaddafi was angry over some things that Kratz wrote in cables to the State Department revealed by WikiLeaks. Then when protests began to rock the Gaddafi regime, the U.S. embassy was shut down 6 months ago. I asked Ambassador Kratz after his meetings with the opposition, the TNC, or Transitional National Council, how can we know they are America's friends?
We have had a very deliberative and very carefully calculated policy. And each step along the way, we have been very careful to analyze what would be in the U.S. policy interest. And certainly one of the subjects that were on our agenda was, who are the TNC and are they leadership that's worthy of our support? The TNC has started literally from scratch. There was no politics. There was no civil society in Libya. There was no scintilla of any oxygen that would enable the Libyan people to breathe any sense of freedom. So they really are starting from scratch. They have showed us that there are ideals and that their vision for a future democratic Libya are very much consistent with ours. Do they have problems? Absolutely. They're up against a very difficult dictator who's ruled that country for 41 years. They inherited a country that was bereft of institutions, bereft of political life, bereft of freedoms. You know, so they've had a long struggle to get back, you know, against a leader and against a system that they inherited, in which Gaddafi literally brought divide and conquer to unprecedented heights. They've been up against the challenge. They have divisions. They have problems, but they're working them through. And I'm fairly confident that as soon as they're able to get into a situation where the situation in Tripoli and the rest of the country is stable, and in which they're able to begin to develop the kind of democracy I think that they really want to reach, I think that the American people should feel very confident and proud that we've had some role to play in this effort. Like I said, it's not going to be easy. They have a tremendous challenge ahead of them. But I think at the end of the day that they're going to do the right thing, as they have been doing, I think, over the past several months.
Noting that it's already cost the U.S. government, according to the Pentagon, over $900 million. More broadly, Ambassador Kratz, why should Americans care? Only because Libya has and in the future will pump oil?
No, I don't think the oil issue is one that really is the most critical. Certainly, we, like other nations, will have commercial interests and other interests with respect to Libya. But the key point is that, number one, we intervened at a point back in March because Libya was on the verge of a humanitarian catastrophe. That is, Gaddafi had threatened Benghazi, and had we not intervened with our coalition partners, we could well have awoken up to a bloodbath of tens of thousands of people. With respect to the American people, while we have paid a heavy cost, I think that the ideals which we espouse, certainly of democracy and freedom, are those that are espoused by the leadership and people of Libya. And second, very critical that that Libya serve as a positive model for other tyrants in the region. This instability in Libya could impact on the region, and especially on the two very important revolutions that we've seen in Tunisia and Egypt. So for many different aspects, I think that the American people have a vested interest in seeing developments in Libya develop positively. We're not going to engage in in a huge effort of multi-billion dollars worth of nation building, we're going to look to our comparative advantage in the sense of what we can do to help the Libyans as they build these institutions. But in no way, shape, or form will it be a sole American effort. We will do it in concert with our coalition partners, as we have done up until now. And as I said, at the end of the day, I think the American people would want us to engage in such a project that could emerge eventually with a democracy in the Middle East.
What's your plan now? Will you get to reopen the United States Embassy in Tripoli?
Well, I think it's a little premature to consider, you know, what we will do. I expect that at some point we and our other partners will go back to Tripoli. That's a subject, I think, for several weeks down the line. Right now, I think we're focused mainly on doing what we can along with our coalition partners to assure that the TNC gets into a governing position and that this long nightmare of this long and bloody but courageous victory by the Libyan people will come to fruition.
That's the United States ambassador to Libya. He's not been in Tripoli all this year, Gene Kretz. Up next, the new Martin Luther King Memorial here in Washington.
Stay with us on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Once again, here's correspondent Dan Revie.
This is not a double-dip recession. The definition of a recession is that gross domestic product, everything the U.S. produces, goes down for two quarters in a row. GDP is still growing, but just barely. On Friday, the government revised downward the GDP increase in the second quarter of this year. The economy grew at an annual rate of 1%. That's not enough to create jobs. A comment from Jill Schlesinger of CBSMoneyWatch.com.
I think this adds to the fear of recession because even though we have growth, and both quarters we have growth, it was a positive number, but we're looking so close to zero, and zero's awfully close to negative, and there are no clear engines of growth in the future. So investors and consumers are very worried that these slow growth rates are going to be persistent through the end of the year.
And the number of Americans filing new applications for unemployment benefits went up in the most recent week to 417,000. Part of that was the Verizon strike, which is now over. But still, Jill Schlesinger says this weekend will probably hurt some more.
Obviously, the events around the hurricane are not good for growth as well, whether it's from tourism or factories or even oil refineries. All of these actions really equate to the same thing, a slowdown in growth.
And while stock market investors had hoped that on Friday Ben Bernanke would come to the rescue, the Federal Reserve Chairman did not make any new commitments in an annual speech to a conference in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. He did not announce another round of bond purchases, so-called quantitative easing by the Fed. That kind of stimulus could still happen next month. As for Congress once again turning to debt and deficit reduction, Bernanke warned that repeating the gridlock we saw recently could have long-term negative consequences. Also here in Washington, there's a new memorial on the National Mall. It's the first one paying tribute to a person who was not President of the United States. It's dedicated to the late Martin Luther King Jr., featuring a very tall stone statue of the civil rights leader. A dedication ceremony, long set for this weekend, has been postponed because Hurricane Irene was approaching. President Obama would have been the featured speaker on Sunday morning to mark the 48th anniversary of the March on Washington, led by Reverend King.
I have a dream.
That was in 1963. This past week, the memorial did open to the public, and CBS News correspondent Pam Coulter was with the preview crowds.
The theme of the King Memorial is Out of a Mountain of Despair, a Stone of Hope. 88-year-old Dabney Montgomery got a message of strength.
Don't hate, but stand. Don't compromise. That's what he's saying up there in that stone.
Fellow Tuskegee Airman James Harvey says the memorial is an inspirational event at a tough time for many, especially minorities.
Hang in there. It won't always be this way. Things will change.
Pam Coulter, CBS News, Washington.
Let's hear some more people who visited in the preview days this past week. CBS News national correspondent Chip Reed chatted with Madeline Coleman, who was there on the National Mall in August of 1963, seeing Reverend King speak at the March on Washington. So Madeline Coleman, now around 70, is a grandmother. How did she feel glimpsing the statue of King?
It was a wonderful feeling. When I first saw the photographs in the paper, I did not think it looked like him. But coming here and just coming around the corner, I was satisfied.
And what does this mean for you, having grandchildren now?
Oh, it's just so wonderful to be able to go back to them after being here, to let them know what a beautiful crowd was here, the fact that the sculpture was just truly amazing.
And what will you tell them when you go home about this and the significance of this and the fact that you were here?
Well, the fact that they've been able to have a good life and to have friends of all races, to be able to attend good schools, to be able to go where they wanted to go without someone shutting the door, that coming here is just a way of just saying thank you.
Thank you to Martin Luther King.
Yeah.
Do you think children today appreciate what this man did for them?
Oh, I don't think so. They don't get a clue. I mean, my grandchildren are very concerned and very compassionate young people, but because they've always been able to interact with all races, because they've always been able to go where they wanted to go, because they do not have people calling them names, it really doesn't register unless perhaps you see something on television. But even sitting down talking to them, they might say, oh, really? But they haven't experienced it. And I think sometimes they don't understand. I think you have to experience racism.
Did you go through that yourself?
Oh, as a child, yes. And I was in the North. I was in Pittsburgh. And it was wild back in the 40s and the 50s. And when I came out of high school in 60, and I was looking for a job, of course, no one really hired me because they said I didn't have enough experience. Well, that was interesting. I came to Washington in 1 week. I was hired by the federal government. But then we cannot let ourselves become embittered by it. We just have to say, that happened, that's the past. What do I want for my future? And that's what Dr. King was all about.
Also visiting the Martin Luther King Memorial, plenty of tourists who are not African American. Susan Saleh was here in D.C. with her three kids, Stephen, Katrina, and Rebecca.
This place is awesome.
Yes, it is.
Yes, it is.
We are very fortunate to be here, actually.
And what are you teaching them about this?
That we are all equal, that there's no separation against any of us. We're all equal, no matter what color we are or what we do in life. Everybody's all the same.
Everybody should be treated equally because we're all alike. Color doesn't matter.
That's right.
There's no difference in everybody. Just because you're a different skin color doesn't mean you have to be treated differently.
Young and old, some of the many tourists coming to the new Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial here in Washington, D.C. It's between the Lincoln Memorial and the Jefferson Memorial. New York City prosecutors dropped their charges of sexual assault against the French politician Dominique Strauss-Kahn, who had been head of the International Monetary Fund, until a hotel maid accused him of attacking her. WCBS Radio's Irene Cornell explains.
In moving to dismiss all charges against Dominique Strauss-Kahn, the DEA says that his accuser has not been truthful on matters great or small. For example, the maid gave investigators a vivid emotional account of being gang-raped by soldiers in her native country. They believed her. Then she admitted she made it all up. She has also given prosecutors three different versions of her actions immediately following the sexual encounter in the hotel room. Prosecutors say they can't be certain of what actually happened or of what she would tell a jury at trial. The DA's conclusion, if we can't believe her, how can we ask a jury to believe her? Irene Cornell, CBS News, New York.
Strauss-Kahn, smiling with his wife, issued a statement saying he's looking forward to resuming a normal life in France. But the hotel maid has sued him, and she doesn't plan to drop that civil case. Please follow us on Twitter for the latest headlines at CBS Radio News. And I'm at Dan Revive.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup, a wrap-up of the week with the correspondents who cover the news. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Once again, here's Dan Ravine.
No time for a pity party. That's what a famous women's basketball coach said when revealing that she's been diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. Pat Summitt, at age 59, reveals she's already having memory problems. The coach of the Lady Vols at the University of Tennessee, Summitt has scored more wins than any other coach in women's basketball. CBS News correspondent Armin Katayan has seen her defiant announcement in a video message to fans.
Summitt says she first experienced symptoms of dementia last season. Forgotten meetings, forgotten plays. In May, she finally went for tests. News of her diagnosis rocking the world of sport.
When you talk about Pat Summitt, you think of strength, and dementia is the opposite of that. And so this is, I think, just jarring because it's not what anyone would ever expect.
Summitt's inspiring, trailblazing strength are part of her legend. Now comes her toughest test.
I've been honest and I've shared my health concerns with you, and now we'll move forward to the business at hand.
Summitt says she hopes to coach at least three more seasons, delegating more responsibility to her longtime assistants. She says she's already taking medicine and doing math problems and puzzles to exercise her mind and beat back the disease.
CBS's Armin Katayan. Now about race, ethnicity, and higher education. Back to correspondent Pam Coulter.
Young Hispanics flooded college campuses last year.
There was a major increase in 18 to 24-year-old Hispanics enrolled in the nation's colleges, up 24%, about 350,000.
To an all-time high of 12.2 million, outnumbering the number of young Black students on campus for the first time. The Pew Hispanic Center reviewed the latest U.S. Census data, and senior researcher Richard Fry says the big enrollment increase reflects several factors.
We've got both extra numbers of Hispanic youth, but we also got some real educational improvements as well.
For example, about three-quarters of Hispanics age 18 to 24 have made it through K-12.
More of them are actually finishing high school. That's what you need to do if you want to go to college.
Fry says Hispanics are really no different from other groups who appreciate the value of higher education.
Most students and their parents, when you ask them, you know, do you want Juan or Susie to go on to college, most of them will say yes, indeed.
There are very practical reasons as well for staying in school. High on the list, an economy that has not replaced the millions of jobs lost during the recession.
They can't work. There's very pretty dismal labor market opportunities. So if you can't work, you might as well be going to college or finishing high school.
But once the jobs come back, Fry says, young Hispanics will want to have the education and training to compete for the best opportunities.
Hispanics as well as non-Hispanics sort of understand that in the U.S. job market, employers really do pay, on average, college graduates significantly more than they pay high school graduates.
Looking down the road, Fry expects Hispanics to build on their educational achievements.
It won't be too long in the next few years that Hispanics will probably be the nation's largest minority among college graduates.
Pam Coulter, CBS News.
Now to Mexico, the drug wars produce a new atrocity. Police say drug traffickers set fire to a large casino in the northern city, Monterrey. The building was crowded. 52 people were killed in that blaze. CBS News correspondent Adrian Bard has more.
At a press conference, the state prosecutor played video from the casino surveillance camera, showing armed men descend from three vehicles, people fleeing the casino, and then a huge burst of black smoke and flame at the entrance. The suspects sped away through the thick smoke, leaving dozens of people trapped inside. Many were seniors or housewives. The gaming house reportedly did not have a permit and kept the emergency exit shut. Adrian Bard, CBS News, Mexico City.
The president of the country, Felipe Calderon, declared 3 days of national mourning for the arson victims. Back now to the United States, a health report.
I'm Barry Bagnato, CBS News in San Francisco. The new school year is already underway here. In most places across the country, it's just around the corner. And parents are being pushed to get vaccinations for their children. But even after years of experience with vaccines, public health officials continue to encounter fears that somehow kids are going to be harmed. The Institute of Medicine convened an expert panel to scour the literature and compose a comprehensive document on vaccine safety. The committee is headed by Dr. Ellen Wright Clayton, a pediatric pediatrics and law professor at Vanderbilt University.
The last comprehensive review of childhood vaccines occurred in 1994. Since then, many vaccines have been added to the immunization schedule, and there has also been a lot more research to try to understand the risk that may be posed.
In a nutshell, the panel found
the benefits of vaccines far outweighed the risks that we found. There were very few adverse health effects, and the majority of them were time-limited or relatively minor.
The vaccine safety debate heated up in recent years with claims in a controversial British study that the vaccine for measles, mumps, and rubella can cause autism. The paper later was debunked. Still, among some parents, the concern persists.
We found, importantly, that vaccines do not cause a certain side effect. The MMR vaccine does not cause autism, and it does not cause type 1 diabetes. The DTaP vaccine, diphtheria, tetanus, and acellular pertussis, does not cause type 1 diabetes.
Conclusive evidence was found associating certain vaccines with 14 specific adverse events, and in general, vaccinations make some people faint.
Every person needs to know what the possible adverse effects can be so that they can know how to respond in the rare event that they occur.
But overall, she says,
I absolutely believe that these findings should be generally reassuring to parents about vaccinating their children.
Barry Bagnato, CBS News, San Francisco.
We've mentioned the features you can hear if you have the free app, CBS Radio News, or anyone with a computer can go to radio.com and listen to nonstop CBS Radio News. This from the series we call Now What?
I'm Jim Taylor, CBS News, celebrating Be Kind to Humankind Week. What do you think? Are most people nice?
For the most part, people are really, really nice, friendly, affable, easy to talk to.
Because it is nice to be nice.
Absolutely.
It's nice to be nice. Are most people nice?
Sure, they behave nicely. But are most people good people? No, of course not.
Most people, you know, they're doing their own thing. I don't think they're thinking about being nice to you.
You're being very nice about saying this, but
it's such a wonderful opportunity to run into people that are not nice, per se, because it's a great opportunity for us to practice our compassion. You know, turn the other cheek, as it were.
I think that most people are nice initially, and then if something happens to make them mad, then they're not nice.
No, I think most people are self-involved. I always think of myself as being optimistic about the world, but pessimistic about people.
No, I think my generation just really brought up a lot of selfish people. Me, me, me. People just really don't care about each other.
I think most people are. I just don't think they try to show it as much.
You get what you give. Being nice. There's no reason not to be nice.
Now what? Be nice. Jim Taylor, CBS News.
Up next, children in poverty, then how to get yourself fired.
Stay with us on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Once again, here's correspondent Dan Revie.
Even though the dedication ceremony for the Martin Luther King Memorial has been postponed due to the hurricane this weekend, many people in Washington, D.C. have been thinking about the civil rights leader. You'd have to think that Dr. King would have been very disappointed, to say the least, to know that child poverty has increased in America. In a study by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, 14,700,000 children are living below the poverty line. In the past decade, that's an increase from 17% to 20% of American kids, not likely to get the right nutrition, perhaps health care. CBS News correspondent Bill Whitaker reports from a low-income part of Los Angeles.
12-year-old Crystal Montez comes to this Compton school 5 days a week for a free lunch.
Here you go. Enjoy your meal.
Thank you. Served by the nonprofit Los Angeles Regional Food Bank to children in this neighborhood where 90% come from families with incomes below the poverty line. $23,350 a year for a family of four.
When my uncle's busy and my mom's at work, we come to lunch so that way we won't like be hungry a lot.
These children are the faces of the growing trend. Based on markers such as infant mortality and teen births, the study found child poverty rose in 38 states between 2000 and 2009. Where poverty hits children hardest, one in four children and more, a wide arc of states mostly across the American South. The recession has made matters much worse, affecting kids like 14-year-old Jose Gallardo and his six siblings. His parents?
Sometimes they don't have that much work. We don't have a lot of money. And sometimes not to pay
not enough money to pay the rent.
Nevada has the highest percentage of children whose parents are under or unemployed. Here, 13%, along with their parents, have been kicked out of houses because of foreclosures.
This survey only runs through 2009, before many recession-racked states started cutting their budgets, many making deep cuts to programs for the poor, which means child poverty has likely gotten worse.
Children who grow up in poverty are more likely to be unemployed adults. Still, poverty hasn't dimmed Jose Gallardo's dreams for the future.
I hope it really works out. I want to be a FBI agent. I would help my family get a better place.
Here you go.
Meanwhile, this LA food program keeps growing. They served 3,000 children a day last year. This year, it's grown to 3,500 a day. Bill Whitaker, CBS News, Compton, California.
As we've reported, U.S. economic growth has slowed down, not enough jobs being created to keep up with population growth. Maybe you need a sense of humor about all this. Jeff Havens, you're a comedian and a paid lecturer to business groups about how to get fired. That's the title of your book, How to Get Fired, The New Employee's Guide to Perpetual Unemployment. You suggest to lose our jobs, we could dress badly, say offensive things in the office, waste time at social networking websites. But Jeff, many American workers actually do behave that way.
Yes, everything that the book is based on is the top 10 most common things that people do to help themselves get fired.
Now, that, of course, means that chapter by chapter, this is bad advice. Fake your resume, establish your incompetence, destroy your work ethic. Let's go back to establish your incompetence, by the way. You really feel that a lot of Americans, you know, at workplaces, they almost prove that if you take a close look at them, they're incompetent?
Well, it's just there are certain behaviors that you can perform that will make people think that you are, whether you are or not. That section of the book was prefaced with the fake your resume. And if you have lied your way into a job, then chances are you applied to one for which you are woefully unqualified. So if you do manage to get that job, the incompetence is already inside of you at that point. It shouldn't be very hard to display it for people so that you can lose the job. But particular behaviors that people can focus on if they want to be incompetent. My favorite is writing like you're texting. Texting not only encourages brevity of communication, but it also encourages brevity of thought. I've never actually seen a complicated idea expressed in a text. And if that's the way that you are sending your emails to people or writing your memos to coworkers, then they're going to start assuming that you're only capable of thinking like a 12-year-old. Whether that's true or not, that's the impression you're going to give. It'll probably establish you as somebody that, if we have to lay somebody off, you're on that short list.
You've also given some thought to, well, behavior at the workplace. That section is called Alienate Your Coworkers. Speak about it seriously for a second. What is it that some people do in the office and maybe don't know that it's terrible?
Well, one of the things that seems to be the most popular is using social networking sites to complain about your boss, to complain about your coworkers and stuff. The internet has given people the illusion of anonymity, and inside of that, there's two things. One, it makes people more likely to say things they would not be comfortable saying to a person's face. But two, a lot of folks forget that some of their coworkers, and in some cases their bosses, are in their friend network. And there are actually websites devoted to people who have gone off on a coworker, who've gone off on a boss and posted it on Facebook or Twitter or somewhere else, only to have a post come 5 minutes later from the boss or from that coworker saying something to the effect that, I guess you forgot that I was in this network. Nothing on the internet stays private, people. So just because you post it and it looks like it's secret on your laptop, it does not mean that it's not going to come back to haunt you.
Well, Jeff Havens, considering that your job is your livelihood, you need the money, you need to spend those hours, you know, keep your brain healthy. It seems to me foolish to have anything about your job, anything about your opinions of coworkers and bosses on social networking sites. Don't you think it should be totally avoided?
Absolutely. And I think a lot of college students, as they're coming out of college especially, they use Facebook, for example, for social purposes. They have pictures of, you know, going to the beach, being drunk, whatever they do. But a lot of them, their senior year, spend a lot of time actually starting to try to manage their social networking profile because, thankfully, at least they're aware of the fact that a lot of what they've posted in their college years has no place in the professional world. And I think the same thing is true about your personal opinions of coworkers, of bosses, things like that.
Now, there's a lot of humor in this book, but the message, as you hear, is important. You're a comedian, a public speaker, now author of How to Get Fired, The New Employee's Guide to Perpetual Unemployment. Jeff Havens, thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Dan.
And now our Weekend Roundup commentator, Charles Grodin.
George Washington said it was a mistake to have political parties, and I agree. People are surprised to hear that I have as many so-called conservative views as I do so-called liberal. I'm certain that if specific questions were asked of Republicans or Democrats, they might find the same is true of them. George Washington accurately predicted that labeling yourself as belonging to a political party would just lead to endless political squabbling. It's obvious that a high percentage of our elected officials put allegiance to party and re-election ahead of country. And look where it's led us. I'm Charles Grodin for the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
And in a bipartisan spirit, let me thank you for joining us. And anytime you want to hear our podcasts, do an internet search for CBS Weekend Roundup. Also, nonstop news and features. Go to radio.com, click CBS Radio News. I'm Dan Revive.
You've been listening to the CBS News Weekend Roundup. The program is produced in the Washington Bureau of CBS News. The executive producer is Howard Arenstein. We'll